Hi, good afternoon, everyone. Today is April 29th, 2010. Rajiv S. Khanna for immigration.com, Law Office of Rajiv S. Khanna, PC. It's a community conference call where we are trying to assist the community in minor requests that might have for information, etc. This call is being recorded. If you don't wish to be recorded, please hang up now. Keep your identities confidential when speaking with me. I'll go over the questions that have been posted, and if there's time remaining, we'll discuss other issues. But please remember, participation in this call does not bind us to represent you as your attorneys. This is just merely an information device, nor are you bound to hire us as your lawyers. Okay, with that said, let me start with the questions that we have before us today. The first question is from Rumble Guy. And I had said earlier before, I don't know how many of you were here, but I have said earlier, if there is any interruption in my voice or something, just give me send me an email to help@immigration.com, and I will, I'll be able to correct whatever problem there is. Okay, so the first question is from Rumble Guy. He says, I passed my interview and test, I guess that's citizenship, and I checked name change request box. I'm still waiting for the approval. I haven't got anything yet. How long name change will take to get approved? Well, it should not be that much of a problem. And if there is a background check with a credit report, etc., that has no bearing on naturalization. Okay? Of course, if you want to check into what the status of your background check, etc., is, you should be able to contact your congressman's office. Congressman's office, okay? If you want to learn more about how to do that, you can go and put in the search term Congressman, in immigration.com. I think the third or fourth entry from the top in the search results tells you details about how to contact your congressman's office. That's a good way to go. Next question is from InnoS. Currently working on EAD since April 9th. Did not renew my H-1. Priority date is January 2007. Company XYZ, which filed for green card, got taken over by another company. By another management, ABC. They are still operating with the same name, which is XYZ. Can you help me understand what the risks for me are in case ABC decides to dissolve XYZ? Well, this is a very pertinent question. We have a lot of people let me take a step back. I want to discuss this with you all because this is a very, very big problem these days. I am doing, on an average, between one and two consultations a day, every day of the week, for people who are getting notice of intent to revoke I-140 that was approved 2 years ago, 3 years ago, even 4 years ago. Okay, today, just 5 minutes ago, I was in a conference call with a client, but not our firm's client, but, somebody who was in a lot of difficulty because their entire life is being unsettled since they've been sent a notice of intent to revoke an I-140, which was approved 4 years ago. Now, under the law, if the company that did your I-140 stops doing business, USCIS can go and revoke your I-140. I think this is a provision that is open to challenge, legal challenge in courts, especially for those people who have ported over using AC-21 to another employer. I would highly encourage you to get together and file a lawsuit against the government. If the government revokes your I-140 because the company who sponsored your case stopped doing business, they can do that. Okay? That's the biggest problem. Now, if XYZ is considered to be a successor in interest, which means that they've taken over company ABC and they are continuing the same business or something similar and they are taking away a green card, then even if ABC stops doing business, I think you're safe. But if they are not successful in interest and ABC stops doing business, you've got a problem. Okay? So it's very difficult for me to tell you what is your best step. The only thing I would say is if you want to be proactive, all of your employees, get together, do a conference call with me. Of course, we'll not charge you for that. Send me an email through the contact us form remind me, because I might want you to get together and be prepared to file a lawsuit if necessary. But in general, I think doing an AC-21 and porting over to another company is probably a good move for you. Okay? At least it gives you another layer of protection. Next question is Zozo000. EAD to H1. If for some reason I have to move from EAD to H1, can I go to H1 with the same or different company from EAD by just applying for H1 in the U.S.? No. You probably will have to leave USA. It is very, very improbable that you'll get your I-94 within USA. So you'll have to get a visa stamp. Okay? Because what happens is, once you have used EAD, you are in authorized period of stay, not in status. You are allowed to stay in USA, but you are not in full status. I actually have written articles on this, both on my blog as well as immigration.com, I think. So look at my blog. It tells you the whole detail about how this works. Next question is Elbow 23. Inadmissibility in asylee adjustment case. I want to tell you something, sir. We don't practice political asylums and related, like, refugee cases. Last time I did a political asylum was somebody we were trying to help as a firm back in, 1989 or 1990. So I have not been involved with these cases for a good 20 years. So I would not be able to give you good advice. But generally speaking, I would recommend not filing a mandamus, because mandamus tends to bring a lot of attention to your case, and this government has become so petty that they will dump all kinds of RFEs and requests for evidence against you when you file a lawsuit against them. Because remember, a mandamus is not a guarantee of a successful case. It is merely a device to hurry up the decision. The government says, fine, you want us to hurry up the decision? We'll hurry up the decision, but then you have to respond to these 500 questions. So it's almost like a petulant child, like a little child. That's how government behaves. The government behaves like a petulant child that's throwing a tantrum. When you file a lawsuit against the government, they're almost like rolling around on the ground crying, wah, wah, wah. That's what we are dealing with here. It's a government made of imbeciles. And I'm very, very unhappy to say that. Sometimes I feel like I'm in Iraq under Saddam's rule, where I will be shot, but there are different ways of getting shot, not just with a bullet. They'll shoot you with RFEs. So avoid your mandamus until you have no choice. It's a very, very unfortunate situation. We have filed a lot of mandamuses against the government. I'm beginning to realize that mandamuses are appropriate in certain cases and not appropriate in certain other cases. By the way, even though I don't do a lot of this, I don't do any political asylum cases, I remember reading a case a few days ago where it is a case in the federal court. Maybe you can tell your lawyers to take a look at it. It's within the last couple of months where this idea of support of a Tier 3 or a terrorist organization was questioned. And I think the court ruled against the government, because the individual who contributed money did it unknowingly, didn't know what he was doing. I'm not sure exactly what the facts of this case, but I happen to... See, I spend half my life reading. I spend a good 1-2 hours, 3 hours a day just reading all the latest developments in law, including all the cases decided in all the 50 states of the United States. So I happened to glance through one of these cases, and there was something about a terrorist organization support, and if I remember correctly, don't hold me on it, but because, I'm not interested in this topic, so I don't spend a lot of time on it. But I do remember there was a federal court case in which the government was defeated by an individual whom the government was trying to keep out on these bases. Take a look at it. It might be worth it for you. Again, I would avoid mandamus until you have no option. Next question, Adriana 1. Valid U.S. green card. Husband is a U.S. citizen. 2 kids from previous marriage. Husband is not the biological father of my kids. 1 kid has a U.S. green card. The second kid has overstayed and is 23 years old. The problem, ma'am, is, as far as I know, because she has probably exposed herself to a 310 bar, and she's probably not entitled to adjustment of status, I don't think you're going to be able to file for her. I want you to do a consultation with a lawyer locally where you are. This is not an easy question to answer. Okay, but ask the lawyer that you deal with questions like, is she eligible to adjustment of status? And if she's not eligible to adjustment of status, how are you going to get her green card? Because if she steps outside USA, she will have 10-year bar. Okay, she can't come back for 10 years. So it looks to me like it's a very difficult case unless you have, you know, unless she gets married to a U.S. citizen. But again, the problem is you don't want her to get married to somebody just to get a green card. That's a felony under the law. Okay, if she's got somebody that she's genuinely interested in and she wants to get married to and they're a U.S. citizen, that would be a very good way for them to get their green card, in my opinion. But do check with somebody locally who can better guide you about your rights and remedies. Next question is from Curious G. I'm a consultant working on EAD. I-140 approved, 180 days over, considering a change to company which is owned by my family member. Well, you see, when you do an AC-21 port over to a family-owned business, that's not a problem. That's not a problem. If you try to do a labor certification firm-based case to them, it would be a problem. Okay? Although we've done a bunch of these cases, as long as you reveal everything to the government, go through certain hoops, even those cases are approved. But for AC-21, there should not be any problem. Okay? What are the risks involved? How can I mitigate them? That's a very difficult question to answer. If the jobs are similar, risks are minimal, you need to review the entries on my blog about AC-21 and the typical issues that surround AC-21. Okay? If you want some more specific information, I would recommend you speak with your lawyer or you arrange for a formal consultation with me. I'll be happy to go over your specific facts. But generally speaking, it's very difficult to say what are the risks involved. Okay, well, one risk is I-140 revocation. But I-140 revocation, unless it is by the government, it should not be a problem. If the employer tries to revoke the I-140, it should not be a problem. Okay, so, you know, it's difficult for me to comment about what the risks are. Usually there should not be any risks in AC-21. Okay. Next question is SOG. I have listened to your last week's talk about the difference between I-140 priority date porting and AC-21 porting. You mentioned that after I-140 is approved, priority date becomes my property, even if the I-140 is withdrawn by the employer. And then he quotes from the William Yates Memorandum. Remember, Yates Memorandum talks about AC-21 portability, not about priority date portability. So here's the situation. Let's say you have been working with the same employer and you got the I-140 approved. Okay? Let's say your 45 is not yet filed. Now, if you change employers without the 45 having been filed, you can carry your priority date with you even if the employer revokes the I-140. That's the way I read the law. Okay? I look at it very carefully the way I see it. The only time you cannot carry your priority date port is when the government revokes your I-140, not when your employer revokes your I-140. Okay? So it appears to me that should not be a problem. Now comes AC-21 issue. Let's say you are working with the same employer, I-140 approved, 45 pending, 180 days. If you leave this employer, you can actually port your green card, AC-21 portability, to a same or similar job, even if the employer revokes the I-140. No problem. The situation you are talking about is, an I-140 is withdrawn before the 45 has been pending 180 days. Of course, at that point, you can neither carry forward your priority date, nor can you do an AC-21 port. Okay? B, an I-140 is denied or revoked at any time, except when it is revoked based upon withdrawal. Withdrawal. So, what they are saying is if the government denies or revokes it, then you cannot port your AC-21. These are all AC-21 related issues. So once again, I'll summarize for you. Your AC-21 can be ported only, your green card can be ported only when your I-140 is approved and 485 has been pending, 180 days, and government does not revoke your I-140. If the employer revokes your I-140, it's no problem. Priority date can be ported any time after the I-140 is approved, whether or not the 45 is pending. Only time you cannot port the I-140 priority date is when the government revokes the I-140. I hope that's clear. Okay. Your situation is I-140 is approved in EB-3. 45 is not yet filed. As soon as I resign, I-140 is most likely to be withdrawn. You should still be able to... I have looked at this law very carefully, at least in my opinion. Even if the employer withdraws the I-140 or revokes the I-140, you should be able to carry your priority date. Okay? I don't know of any reason why you should not be able to. At least that's the way I read the law. Next question, Dr. Sanguin. I'm a green card holder since August 2005, applying for naturalization this month, 31 months of physical presence, you need only 30, and I've been traveling to and fro from India with no single trip exceeding 5 months. That's very good. During my time there, I've been pursuing a medical education with the intent to practice in USA. Do you think, just be truthful. As long as you've not taken a full-time job outside USA, and you're just educating yourself, you're going through medical college, I think they should be able to accept that. Okay? Next question, and you should get your naturalization. Next question, but please don't, misrepresent anything. Be truthful. Next question is Fruity Bar, under-the-table job. This is on behalf of a friend. He's got a green card. Can he take a job which is under the table? I guess what it means is that's a job that the employer is paying you cash and you're not paying taxes on it. I think it's always a bad idea. It could become a problem, in my opinion. Next question, SK-2008. Notice of intent to deny I-140. Well, I was just mentioning that. Notice of intent to deny has become so common. Notice to revoke has become so common. Every day I see one or two or three cases like this.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay. Everybody, please keep yourself on mute on your phone. I don't want to put people on mute. Just keep yourself mute. Next question is, notice of intent to deny I-140, a three-year diploma in mechanical engineering, three-year BTEC in mechanical, total of 9 years experience, seven experience with previous employer. And now notice of intent says, I think you sent me an email also. I'm not sure if I asked you to consult with me and show me copies of all your documents, but usually what happens is, if you get a BTEC, it's a four-year degree, and the reason you're getting it in 3 years is because your three-year diploma is being counted towards 1 year of education. I personally feel that you should be able to get an EB-2 on that basis. On top of that, you've got an MTEC. Okay? So generally speaking, it looks to me like you qualify for EB-2, but I'm not sure because I haven't looked at your paperwork. Okay, so you want us to consult for you, go ahead and approach us for a formal consultation. I'll take a look at your paperwork. But generally speaking, I think it should work. Depends upon the language of the labor certification. It depends upon what the government is objecting to. All these things are the variables here. Next question, Pavan Vasarala. I'm on H-1B since 2007. For the past 1 month, my employer has placed me on part-time as work being slow. Only worked a few hours this week. My boss says he cannot promise me any number of hours. But they have to pay you full-time. If they have put down your H-1 as full-time, they are required by law to pay you full-time. Okay? I would very strongly encourage you, in cases like this, to file a complaint with the Department of Labor Wage and Hour Division against the employer. And then, if necessary, move to tourist visa, or at least apply for it. That should protect you to a large degree. Read my blog on how to file the complaint, as well as if you apply for a B visa to maintain status, how does that work out? Okay? Or an F visa if you want to go to student status. Okay? I'll be happy to do a free consultation with you. Why don't you do this? Send us an email through the contact us form, and just say that you were on today's conference call, and I would remember that I had told you that I'll be happy to talk with you and guide you about what you should do, and there'll be no charge for that, okay? My team will be happy to get in touch with you. They'll of course, clear it with me, and then I'll talk with you. Next question is A.S. Manu. What are my options to return back to U.S.? I went to USA in 2001 on H-1B visa, Software Technology Group, Portland, Oregon, and continued working in U.S. till 2008. So almost, 7 years. Company applied for green card in 2003. 2007, I-140 was approved and 45 was pending. Now the problem is you've gone out and your EAD, advanced parole, everything seems to have expired. Well, this is a tough one because typically if your advanced parole is expired, there can be this view that your 45 is no longer valid, okay, or it's been abandoned. However, I think one thing you can try is there's a little bit of a gray area in the law. What if you convert it to H-1 status? Since you've been outside USA for more than 1 year, you're entitled to an H-1 status. Okay? So what you could do is, you could try to get an H-1 visa and come back into USA and see if the government considers you to still be holding valid 485. If not that, then what you can do is convert your 485 to consular processing. Consular processing. Those are the two options. Come back on H-1 and argue with the government, Sharmaji, or convert it to consular processing. Those are the two options you've got. But in any case, be prepared to answer the government on how the employer is willing to do without you for so long when they claim to have a permanent job for you. Okay? Next question is Deep T1, I-140 and priority date. I have a question about my I-140 and priority date. If my I-140 is approved and I change my company and again start labor, if priority date becomes current, what are my options? Within how many days we have to file for 45 when the priority date becomes current? Look, when the priority date becomes current, how does the visa bulletin work? Visa bulletin comes out on or around 15th of every month, and it gives you the picture for the next month. So you have to file your 45 within the next month of when the priority date becomes current. Okay? Because if now is April, so on 15th of April, Visa Bulletin came out and told us what dates are going to be current in May. So we have all of May to file your 45. 45 must reach INS within the month of May. If in June your priority date is still current, no problem, you can file in June or July. Your priority date has to be current. Okay? Next question, K. Manava. I and my wife have pending 45 with mine as the primary. My wife is already using her EAD. Daughter was born in India. She is on H-4. Now, he wants to go on to, first of all, when can I file 45? You can only file 45 when the priority date is current. If I want to go to a full-time position using my EAD, and that way I will lose my H-1B, can I do that without affecting my daughter's legal status? No. Your daughter, Kiran, is on H-4. If you lose your H-1, she is no longer on H-4. Keep that in mind. Okay? Now, there may be other options on her going outside USA to get her visa stamping or her consular processing done, being out of status. Discuss that with your lawyer. These are options that I don't usually recommend. But they might be, if she's under 18, she doesn't accrue unlawful presence. So that's something to think about. But then you will not be able to do her 45. That could become a problem. So next question, Shekhar Raja. He has a question about promissory notes. Mr. Raja, I cannot comment about promissory notes. These are specific to a particular state. This is not immigration law, which we can practice in all 50 states or practice for people from all 50 states. This is essentially a matter of state law. Promissory notes are governed by state law. So you need to talk with a lawyer practicing contract law in the state in which that particular contract has been stated for. Okay. Next question is Willis Rover. This is the last question, so I anticipate about half an hour for today's question. We have plenty of time. I should be able to deal with all the questions you folks have today. Last question says, my partner has just received a letter from KCC advising her of a win. This is a visa lottery, okay? She also added our 2-year-old son. I was married before, but now separated from mother of my daughter, all living in another country. She did not mention my daughter from my first marriage. Can we now add her? You should be able to. Why don't you contact the consulate? And you have to be married. Being partners is not good enough. Unless the law of the country where you are living together allows you to be common law husband and wife. Okay. Now, these are issues. First of all, remember, we don't do DV lottery cases. Simple reason, most of these cases don't require a lawyer. So I think your best bet would be to start making your inquiries with the consulate and then do a consultation with the lawyer who does DV cases if something is not clear. Okay. That's what I would recommend. Now, with that, I am done with all the questions that were posted. If you want to talk with me, any follow-up questions on what has been posted, press *6 and start talking. *6.
Hey, Rajiv.
Hello.
Hi, Rajiv.
Hello, sir.
Hi, Rajiv. This is Zozo. I think it's question number 3.
Right.
You said that most likely I would have to leave the country once I file my H-1 and then get a stamp and come back, right?
Right.
Okay, but my question is, even if I still have a valid EAD after I file my H-1, and even if I have my AP, can I'll leave the country, I'll get my approval for H-1, and then can I travel back on AP?
It's a very interesting question. In my view, no. You can travel back on AP, but I don't think you are converted to H-1 by that device.
No, that's fine. I'm not converted without a stamp, you mean to say?
Yes, because what you need is an I-94 that says H-1.
Right.
And when you come back on AP, you won't get that
I-94. Oh, okay. What if I get my, if I'm lucky, if I get my I-94 sitting in the U.S.?
No, then there is no problem. Then you're all good.
Then I don't have to leave the country, right?
No, sir, you do not.
Okay, and also, you were talking about this. Nowadays, you're hearing a lot about intent to deny this I-140.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are those for applicants who are applying right now for 140, or are those for already who have already got approval and then now they're sending denials?
Oh, I just got an email, and somebody said they couldn't hear me. Kirpal, Poonam, are you on the phone? I just got an email, said somebody just sent me an email saying they can't hear us. Huh, that's interesting.
Okay.
Anyhow,
so
the answer is, question is, who are these I-140s being denied, etc.?
Right.
Some of these I-140s were approved 4 years ago. Now they are being denied, your document is fraudulent, your education is insufficient, your degree is a 3-year degree. They are going back and revoking these I-140s after having them approved for 4 years. In my opinion, that's a very objectionable way of doing things. Although, I don't think we can take it to court because the government is justified when they have reason enough to do it.
But so in that case,
it creates chaos in the lives of people who have been depending upon these approved I-140s. I have no problem if they disapprove the I-140, deny the I-140 when it's filed. But for them to then go back and revoke it 4 years later, I think it's unconscionable.
So in that case, what do we do?
That's what I want to know too. Okay. So what we are doing is, in some of these cases, we are going back and fighting with the government aggressively. In some of these cases, we are figuring out alternate strategies. One example is, if my case gets denied, I'll file an appeal against it. While the appeal is pending, I can keep getting H-1 renewals and start another green card process. It sucks. It really does suck. I'm sorry to say that.
Mm-hmm.
But we may not have a choice. Every case has its own strategy. We have no choice.
Right.
Okay?
Okay, thank you.
Good luck, Joseph.
Yeah. Hi, Rajiv.
Hello,
This is Curious G. This was regarding a question about my family members joining my family members company.
Which one? I'm sorry, which was the question?
Curious G.
No, that I remember. Hang on.
Yes.
I-140 approved, 182 years. Oh, yeah, I got it. Yeah, I remember. Your
yes. I understand that I can file the AC-21, but one of my friends told there is a Kingdom Kit law which, prevents such family members to be taken
up
by...
Not for AC-21 porting purposes.
Okay.
The law does not allow you... Let me put it to you this way. When you do a PALM case or a labor certification through a family-owned company, government raises an objection. They say, look, you are not really willing to hire anybody who's qualified. You basically want to hire your own family. But AC-21 is a different ballgame altogether. AC-21 you can actually do for your own company also. If you look at the Gates Memorandum from May 2005, it says so. It says, can I port to my own company? And they say, yeah, you can.
Okay, in that case, I understand, because since I have an EAD, I can, my wife also is on EAD, she can open a company, I can be her employee, right?
Look,
in that case?
The answer is yes, but I'm very reluctant to recommend that as the first course of action for the simple reason. Government has become extremely unreasonable. They are doing things that I find, and I don't say these things lightly. I'm a responsible person. I don't say these things lightly. They are behaving in many ways like unruly, petulant children. They're running around doing things that we have not seen being done in years, in decades.
Okay, I understand.
Some of these things are blatantly illegal.
I understand.
Some of these things are very unfair. So, to answer your question, can I do it? Yes, you can. But I don't know what the government is going to do about this. I mean, I saw a case the other day where Administrative Appeals Office was actually going against a written memorandum from the government saying, well, we don't really care what the written memorandum says. We have to go with our own interpretation of the regulations. So, you know, it almost seems like nothing is reliable anymore. Immigration law has become more chaotic than it normally was.
Okay, I understand. So it is as good as going to any other company if I were joined my family member company. Like, it is as good as going to any other company, the risk to be as good as filing H-21, right?
Yeah, I don't think it should be any more risky than going to another company it would be going to a relative-owned company.
Okay. Because she's my family member, she's not my wife, but my direct family member.
That's not a problem.
Okay, I understood.
Job is genuine and you have same or similar job responsibilities, salary, title, you should be fine.
Okay, because I will be doing consulting on that. It will not be, you know, on their roles, but it will be a consulting position.
It's not the nature of the whether you do it on-premises, in-house. It is what the job requires. If you are a program analyst, you know, as long as you're doing program analyst work, same job description, similar job description, whether you do it in-house or as a consultant doesn't really matter.
Okay, I got you. Thank you. And one last question. Regarding, if my current company... with my current company, who is holding my GC process, gets dissolved or collapsed, or, you know, because of this economic situation, what would be my options to do for that?
Here is the bad news. There is a law in the books that says if any time before the approval of your green card, if the company who sponsored the I-140 stops doing business, government can go back and revoke your I-140. When they revoke the I-140, then they tell me, oh, you can't do AC-21 portability anymore. I think that is an absolute nonsense interpretation of the law. It's an illegal interpretation of the law. It should be challenged in court, and you will challenge it. You will have no other choice. And
okay.
I think if you challenge it, I think you'll win.
Okay, so in case if it were taken care over by some other company and they still do the business, that should be fine, right?
As long as they are doing same or similar business and they meet the definition of successor and interest, we should be okay.
Okay, I understand. So it is always, it's not that I can wait until that happened and do my step, but it is good to do a portability, then repent it later, right?
I think that is the better option for you. It at least gives you a stronger argument in court if you end up going to court on this.
Okay, so is there any lead time in between all the process, Mr. Rajiv?
There is no lead time. And just call me Rajiv, please. Nobody calls me Mr.
Sorry.
No,
okay.
No big deal.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Okay, sure.
Good luck to you, sir.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Anybody else?
Hi, Rajiv. This is SK 2008. I'm talking about the question number 11.
What is the question, sir?
That is NOID in 140. Mine is like a first 140.
Hang on one second. Yeah, yours is... You sent me an email also, right?
Right. I sent an email, right?
Yeah. I remember reading your case. And I think I told you to just go ahead and make an appointment. I really don't know what to tell you. Looks to me that even your BTEC is a four-year degree. It is not a three-year degree because they give you 1 year off for having a diploma.
Correct.
Right?
BTEC, in the sense, it's like only 3 years course. We have like a separate classes and separate rooms for the 3 years. It's not like we will sit in the second year of 4 years degree.
Oh, so yours, because most of these BTEC cases that I have seen, they were actually four-year degrees and they were given 1 year off for having a diploma.
Right, but here it's designed for 3 years only for the diploma holders.
SK2008. It looks like there's a lot of disturbance. People have just unmuted themselves. I'm going to mute everybody else, and then I'll tell you to press star 6. Hang on 1 second, okay?
Okay.
I'm going to mute everybody else again. Everybody again. SK2008, press star 6.
Yeah, Raju, this is SK2008.
Yeah, okay. So now everybody's go ahead. So,
right.
Yes. In that case, you know what? It looks like a difficult case to save. Because the government can claim that, well, you have a 3+2 combo or 3+3+2 combo, which may not be equal to a U.S. master's degree. It's difficult for me to advise you without knowing exactly what they are complaining about. Are they saying that you don't have the equivalent of a U.S. master's degree? Is that what they're saying?
Yeah, here they mentioned like the beneficiary must produce one degree that is determined to be the foreign equivalent of a U.S. bachelor degree plus a post-bachelor degree.
No, that is an incorrect statement of the law. Your lawyer should be able to fight this. That's an incorrect statement of the law. If you were relying only on your bachelor's degree, it could be argued that you need a single bachelor's degree. By the way, if your application was filed with BS plus 5, you could combine degrees to a certain extent. There are certain formulas you could use.
Yeah,
but when you are doing master's, you are allowed to combine degrees.
Yeah, but unfortunately, my lab is only the master's in engineering plus 2 years of experience. There is no bachelor's for 5 years, nothing.
Look,
only
here's what I would suggest. Even if you lose the case, file an appeal. Okay?
Okay.
File an appeal. In the meantime, start a second green card. Okay?
Okay.
While the appeal is pending, next couple of years, you can keep getting H-1 extension.
Okay.
Once the appeal is decided, if against you, talk to us. Maybe we want to file a lawsuit or something. But by that time, I think the green card that you would have filed would then make you eligible to keep getting H-1 extensions beyond the appeal.
Okay. Actually, my lawyer is suggesting that we will file in EB-3. I don't know whether that will work or not.
I don't know the answer to that question. EB-3 is an option, but the degrees are going to be an issue. It's difficult for me to comment. I would certainly say that file the application in EB-2, but put in some kind of protective language so that if the EB-2 is denied, you can still get EB-3.
Okay, so you mean to say that once it is denied, I need to file it again with the EB-3?
What I'm saying is that when you draft a labor certification, you can put in language which is in good faith, which is genuine language, which says, look, you know, even if you deny my EB-2, I'll give me EB-3.
Okay.
So there's a possibility of doing it that way. Again, you can discuss it with your lawyers. I'm not sure how they are doing the cases, but they could have put in some language like that.
Okay. But you mean to say that it's not possible to win this NOID case?
I don't know the answer to that question, sir. I'm still shooting blanks here. I'm still making guesses. I don't know what your evaluations say. I don't know,
Because my attorney already, he submitted like 3 evaluations from the 3 different agents along with the 140. But still, you know, they showed this NOID.
I feel that this is certainly a case that you might be able to at least fight in appeal, as well as you might even take it to court. I don't know what's going to happen with it, but I think it's worth pursuing.
Okay, so your suggestion is better to go for appeal.
Appeal you have to do. There's no question in my mind.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for you.
Good luck, sir. Folks, anybody else?
Hello, Rajiv. This is Frog here.
Yes, sir.
I have asked you a question about the I-140 priority date porting.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, you confirmed it to me. Thanks for that. But my question now is, before I resign from my current employer, does the I-140 receipt is enough for me to use it later?
You have the I-140 approval?
Yes, the receipt and approval, both I have.
That's all you need.
All right. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Good luck.
And one more question is, if this I-140 is based on labor substitution, is it a problem?
Still the same law.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome. Next question, folks.
Mr. Rajiv.
Yes, sir.
This is Pavan, question number 12.
What was the question?
Based on being me being on H-1 2007 and my employer put me on part-time.
Oh, yes. What I want to do is I want to talk to you separately. And
sure,
there'll be no charge for this conversation. Let me see if I can guide you a little bit better.
Okay.
Okay. We actually had a client like you. He approached me about a year and a half ago. Similar problem. I had him go through this process that I'm recommending to you. It worked out fine for him. And I'm hoping the same thing will work out for you. When you call me, I'll explain to you what I'm thinking.
Sure.
Okay. And basically the idea is we use a combination of filing a complaint and converting you to B status and explaining to the government there's a complaint pending and this is what happened, that's the reason I fell out of status. I fell out of status not because I didn't want to work, it's because the employer didn't give me a job. Okay? So hopefully two things will happen. One, you get the opportunity to spend 4 or 5 months looking for another job. Okay? And two, you get paid for the entire time you are here.
Okay.
Until the employer revokes the H-1.
Okay. And how would I get to talk to you later on?
Just send an email through the contact us form on immigration.com. I'll give you Leslie's phone number. Hang on 1 second. Just look up the phone number of our Stanton office. Stanton office. I can never remember our own phone number.
Okay.
And just talk with Leslie. Tell Leslie that Rajiv said in today's conference that there's going to be a free consultation for me. Please schedule me. They should be able to schedule you next week.
Okay.
Before you talk with me, make sure you've read my entries on blog on how to file a complaint.
Okay.
And applying for a B visa if you get laid off on your H-1.
Okay. My question to you, it's a little more complicated. I could talk to you in detail later on, but
sure.
The only question I have is how my last two paychecks, I worked only like 3 or 4 days in this month. I did get my paychecks in 2 weeks. I got two paychecks, but they're reflecting very few hours. So if for some reason I get a job next week and I have to produce pay stubs,
that's where the complaint helps. If you provide a copy of the pay stubs along with a copy of the complaint that you have filed, it shows the USCIS that the reason you don't have the full wages is because the employer didn't give you the job.
Okay.
And it's not because of any fault on your part.
Okay. Not necessarily H-1 has to be, my pay stub has to show 40 hours?
It has to show whatever was stated on the LCA and the H-1 paperwork. There are jobs that are for 10 to 40 hours. There are jobs that are 30.5 hours. There are jobs that are 35 hours. So whatever has been stated on the H-1, that must be reflected in your paychecks.
Okay.
So it's not required that you must have 40-hour jobs, but if 40 hours is what has been stated on the H-1 paperwork, maybe you could get away with 35 or 36 hours, but if you are being paid for 10 hours, the employer has a problem.
Okay, this is the first time they've done it and they're not aware of it and they just put me in part-time and I'm not aware of it.
Look, if the H-1 allows for part-time, then there is no problem.
And I've read somewhere that you could do H-1 part-time, like amending your petition.
I'm sorry?
I've read somewhere on the blogs that you could amend your H-1B to be a part-time where you mention a number of hours that the employee can work.
Yeah, you can amend your H-1, yes.
Okay. And if you can file that and if I can back that up, complain against my company, will that work?
It'd be difficult because how do they justify the past?
Okay. I see your point.
Okay,
sir. I'll talk to you in more detail when I call you.
Sounds good.
Okay, thanks, sir.
All right, sir. Good luck. Folks, anybody else has any questions?
Hey Rajiv, this is again SK2008 about that 140 NOID.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, generally speaking, what is the percentage of winning that case in these cases, like for the NOID, instead of appeal?
What is the percentage chances of? Well, it's very difficult to say. It depends upon the case.
Okay. Because suppose if I come to your office, would that be help me or?
Well, sir, I am not a magician. I can only work under the law, right? So all I can tell you is it depends upon the case. I mean, it's difficult for me to say this case is going to be won or not won until I've looked at the case in detail, examined what the possible arguments to and against our case are.
Okay. Yeah, because they are talking about like a 1 degree that is determined with the foreign equivalent means I don't have like 1 degree because I can show with the combination of degrees. To show the bachelor degree itself, I need to show with the diploma plus bachelor's. My 3 years degree plus 3 years diploma.
Yeah, see, I really don't know. Probably you should discuss with the university whether they consider this to be equivalent to a 4 year bachelor's degree.
Okay. So
that may be your best chance to win this case.
So university letter?
Yep.
Okay. Is there any other kind of letters that do I need to get evidence other than the university letter?
It's difficult. I don't know what else you can get. But that seems to be an obvious choice.
Okay. Yeah, thanks, Rajiv. And another question about the H-1 extensions, like how that employee-employer relationship plays in the role of the H-1 extension? Still it is there in the H-1 extension?
Employer-employee role? I'm sorry, I didn't understand that question.
The employee-employer relationship. There is a new memorandum.
Oh, yes. January 8th memorandum. So what is the question on that?
Yeah, I mean, still they're considering that employee-employer relationship?
Are you asking me, is that still an issue? The answer is yes.
Yes.
They are asking for H-1 purposes, we are still having to deal with that issue, yes.
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, thank you.
You're welcome. Good luck to you, sir. All right, bye-bye. Folks, anybody else has any questions? All right. I have an email here from...
Oh, Rajiv?
Yes, sir.
Rajiv?
Yes, I can hear you.
Yeah, one quick question. With respect to the pay stubs, right, for H-1, for EAD, do I need to have continuous pay stubs throughout my tenure, or how flexible is with respect to that?
Well, they can go back. Technically, they can go back and ask you to produce every pay stub for every time you were in the United States, every month you were in the USA. Unless you have some personal reasons where you took time off, such as a sickness in the family or tourism or preparing for an exam. But typically, they can ask you for pay stubs covering every month of the year that you were in U.S.
I see. For some reasons, my company couldn't issue for 3 months, and then they consolidate all the hours and they paid in a single check.
I think that's a violation of the law, but it's not something that should harm you. So if they did that, I think you should be okay.
But still the pay period was not reflecting all the previous ones, so still is there any alternative to cover up that thing?
If you have been paid the total amount that was supposed to be paid, you should be okay.
Okay, it's not about the pay period has to reflect the previous month.
That's right.
Okay, understood.
But technically, they are required to pay you in equal installments every month. You know, if their pay period is monthly, they must pay you every month. They can't, not pay you 3 months and then pay you all together in 1 month. That's what they're supposed to do. But as a practical matter, if they pay you the total amount, the Department of Labor or USCIS is likely to be more charitable towards that situation.
Okay. And my wife is also on EAD, and she's getting jobs on and off, consulting jobs. So she's also not continuous pay, and she's filed as a dependent EAD. So what would be a guideline for her?
She's on a dependent EAD. What would be the guideline? Guideline to do what?
about the pay stubs, is it same as
no,
the pay stubs?
If somebody has an EAD, there is no requirement, especially for derivative beneficiary, there is no requirement that she be paid. She can sit at home if she wants.
Okay. I understand. Okay, thank you. And if she gets any kind of a 1099 paid job, will that be okay for her? You know what I mean?
She can get a 1099, it's no problem at all.
Okay, sure. Thank you.
You're welcome. Anybody else has a question? I have a question I got on the email when we were talking. My son got ticket for disturbing the peace by violent manner and fistic encounter misdemeanor charges. Never taken to jail, never fingerprinted, just a ticket. He took a class of pre-trial prevention program. His charges were dismissed. He has a green card now and he's eligible for citizenship. I was wondering if we could apply for his citizenship as it was his first offense last year in September 2009. Well, look, it's a very, very complicated question to answer because there are states in which misdemeanors can be a problem even for your green card. It depends upon how the misdemeanor is defined in that particular state. I would recommend that you get a detailed consultation with your criminal defense lawyer as well as your immigration lawyer involved. It's not an easy question to answer. Sometimes if the misdemeanor is an aggravated misdemeanor, you could end up having a problem with your green card, with your son's green card also. Okay? So, not an easy question to answer. Typically, when you apply for naturalization, USCIS looks only to the 5 years immediately before the application. Okay? But if they want, they can go back as far back as they want to determine good moral character. So therefore, even if you applied in September 2014, technically they could look beyond the last 5 years and look into this offense. But if somebody has maintained good moral standards, you know, at least for a couple of years, 2, 3, 4 years, you may have a good chance of getting naturalization through and may not get trouble with the green card. But do check whether this is considered to be an aggravated misdemeanor, what the maximum possible penalty, etc., for this crime are. I think it should be fine. It doesn't look to me like a major issue, but it's not something you can dismiss lightly. Okay? Folks, it looks like we pretty much have covered everything that needs to be covered this conference call. I appreciate your being here, and I'll see you in a couple of weeks. Bye-bye.
Thank you.